My name is Harriet Tramer, and I'm glad that you are joining us today as I host Reaching for the Gold. This show is broadcast every other Tuesday afternoon at this time, and I hope you will make it a part of your schedule. Both of our guests today are working to educate people, nudging them gently away from attitudes that have long prevailed, but that they believe need to be seriously reexamined. Bullying was once considered nothing more than a normal part of childhood, something that children must learn to tolerate or even treat with light humor. But Linda Colbreath, our first guest today, maintains that bullying is a serious matter, not just something that people should accept with a shrug. In fact, she goes so far as to claim that it has the potential to scar somebody for life. She has spread this message through her best-selling book, Bullies Plus Teen Dating Equal Bullying, and by developing an anti-bullying program that involves teens, parents, and educators. Linda has also spoken to literally thousands of people throughout the country about these matters. Until recently, death was a taboo that people were lax to discuss, and that same veil of secrecy shrouded hospices, which were simply considered places people go to when they are ready to die. But Heidi Barman, our second guest, is encouraging Americans to move away from that attitude and make hospice care an integral part of end-of-life experiences. She feels that the support these facilities provide could prove life-enhancing because they offer persons whom medical intervention might no longer benefit art therapy, music therapy, spiritual counseling, and even a chance to leave a legacy such as a video of them playing the piano. Heidi serves as chair of the Hospice of the Western Reserve's African American Outreach Committee, and she is also spiritual care coordinator for that organization. Linda, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Harriet. I appreciate your inviting me to come on your show.
Why have you become involved in anti-bullying efforts? Why?
Oh, that is just a real simple question, Harriet, and it's got a really, really simple answer. I am a survivor of abuse, of bullying, and I know what it can do for somebody's psychic, for somebody's self-esteem for the rest of their life, unless it's dealt with and maybe through extensive counseling or something. But absolutely the best way to keep that from happening is prevention and stopping the bullying before they can get a handle on somebody and just bully and bully and bully and bully.
Now, how would you respond to people who would say, well, maybe, I mean, anything could scar you for life, what can I say? But bullying, this is just part of growing up. It happens. Boys are boys, girls are girls, they bully. You take
that is
it,
true.
It is
part of life. And even goes way beyond a dating relationship. A lot of bullying happens in a sibling situation where you have a brother or a sister that's picking on another brother or sister. Either they're too skinny, or they're too fat, or they're too tall, or they're too short, or their hair looks funny, or maybe they wear glasses. And parents don't realize that that, too, is a form of bullying, and it can very easily affect how somebody feels about themselves and how they view themselves for a very, very long time. And when they view themselves that they don't deserve any better, that it's lower a self-esteem, then that opens the door for a relationship in a dating situation where somebody is bullying and picking and being abusive, whether it's emotionally or physically. And the person that's being bullied thinks, well, this is the way that it's supposed to be, when it's really not.
Mm-hmm. But again, bullying between siblings, reading the Bible, Cain and Abel, it's treated as just, well, you're competitive.
Well, Cain and Abel got a little bit further than competitive because one of them lost their life and the other ended up being charged with murder by God himself on that. But there should have been a situation where maybe Adam and Eve stepped in and kept that from happening. I don't know. But it is a part of life, and unfortunately it's a bigger part of life than most people could imagine. If you take some of the statistics, 24% of the female homicide victims are between the ages of 15 and 24 years old. And 70% of the severe injuries and death occur when a young lady is trying to break up in a relationship with a guy. And relationship violence is the number one cause of injury to women that are under 50. And the boys, 63% of the boys that are arrested for murder between the ages of 11 and 20 are arrested for murdering the man that was abusing their mother or assaulting their mother. And the date rape victims are young women, most of them, 38%, are between the ages of 14 and 17. And if a teenager should become pregnant, 70% of the partners are going to abuse them and perhaps even kill them or kill the baby. So in the United States, one out of every three females will be abused at the hands of somebody that's supposed to be caring for them and be kind to them. That's
now,
a significant, widespread deal there.
Do you think our attitude has changed? As I indicated, a lot of people feel, what are you talking about? This is just part of life. Do you think that attitude is changing?
I think it is because of awareness, and I think it should be. It's not, you can't go too long on the news without finding someone that's committed suicide because of the bullying, or somebody that's threatened suicide, or somebody that has been killed at the hand of somebody that was supposed to take care of them. I think the fact that it's on the news media, that people are beginning to understand, hey, this could be my child. Maybe this was me, and they didn't realize that beforehand. That was their little deep dark secret that they kept hidden from everybody. And I think it's coming out, and I think that's a good thing.
Now, how you seem to be defining bullying is much broader than somebody bumping somebody against a locker or calling them a name on the playground. You seem to be talking about power issues, somebody taking power over another person.
Yes, it is a power issue, and it runs the gamut from those people that throw somebody up against a locker or pins them down on the playground. But it goes way beyond that because abuse can be emotional, it can be physical, it can be sexual. And sometimes you see the emotional abuse, the verbal abuse, if you will, starting off, and then it may escalate to physical. And then as it escalates even more, there's the possibility of real injury, physical injury done, that requires hospitalization or that even ends up in death. But the damage is done and it leaves the scar emotionally, regardless of what kind of abuse it was. But yes, it's real broad. It's not just one little incident or one thing. It goes in a lot of different branches there.
From what you were saying, again, this is a power issue. It's an effort to make somebody feel powerless and ashamed. In other words, I must be blank, whatever you want to put in blank, that people are treating me this way. How did you and others get the strength to stand up and say, yes, I was bullied, and no, this is not something I did wrong. This is something wrong that was done to me. How did you get that strength to stand up publicly and make that statement when usually people are embarrassed by this and try to hide what's happening?
I did hide it for a long time, and I heard some other people who spoke up and said, this happened to me, and it caused me to feel like garbage. And then I didn't feel like I was worth anything else. And as I listened to a few others begin to speak out a few years back, I learned that, hey, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one. And by them speaking out, it encouraged me to seek the inner strength and to go forward and to even actually get some help. And I'm thinking, well, if this happened to me, certainly it's happened to others. And the more people that I talk to, the more teens I talk with in schools, the more younger people even in upper elementary school, the more I realize this happens so widespread, it's unreal.
If you are an older person, we talk about aging on this program. Everybody is aging, so we're talking about everybody. But if you are an older person, long beyond the playground, maybe long beyond even a work environment where bullying can occur, and you were bullied, how can you get a hold of yourself and say, that doesn't have to define me? How can you do something of that nature?
I think you're going to have to seek some spiritual guidance here, and this is the way that I went. And I think there's a lot of things in the Bible. Is it all right for me to speak on this direction, Harriet? Or
yes.
Do I need to not? Okay, I can go this direction. There's a whole lot in the Bible about who you are and how God loves you and how He made you. And when you start putting that into your heart and into your mind, and it starts coming out of your mouth, then you begin to realize the other things don't count. What other people did to you really doesn't matter, and it doesn't define you. You're defined by who your Creator says you are.
Mm-hmm. You hear stories about people who were bullied and then confronted the bully. Have you ever done that, or is that something you would advise, or would your advice be, that's behind you, don't let them define you enough to confront them?
In my particular case, there was a few that I did not confront, and there's one in particular I will not confront, and that is a former husband. We were married for 52, 53 weeks. Years ago, he nearly killed me, and I keep up with his whereabouts, and I have forgiven him because unforgiveness is like an acid that eats the container that holds it. But that does not mean I want to be in the same room with him or that I confronted him. And I would not, unless I was put on a stand. He's already served some time in prison for assaulting other women and even a three-year-old child. And he's worked on a lot of lives there that he's damaged besides his own. But for me confronting him, it's just not going to happen. I just don't care to go through it again.
Mm-hmm. If you have a child or a grandchild who is being bullied, what can you say to them to protect themselves? Now, I hear what you're saying about not letting it define you, but when you're an elementary school child and the world you see is in that elementary school, that's pretty hard. That's a lot to ask from a young child. What would you say to them, or how might you talk to somebody to bully-proof them, to prevent them from being bullied? Or can't you?
I believe you can to a certain degree, but not probably 100%. But I think if the lines of communication are open and you talk and you make sure that you're not judging the child or grandchild, and you're not putting it down as, oh, well, you know, just get over it. It doesn't count. It doesn't matter. I think when you make it small and it's so big in the eyes of a child, and it is big, then I think you're minimizing and shutting the doors for communication. But communication is one of the best things. And a child needs to be able to talk with a parent or grandparent or aunt or uncle or someone that they trust is older, and that can show them a lot of love and show them acceptance and help them learn to make defense plans themselves for if they are in danger physically, and to have the courage to report it if it's just verbal bullying or even shoving against a locker or being pinned down in the playground or something like that, that they have the courage to go to the authority figure in the school, whether it's a teacher or whether it's principal or assistant principal or counselor, and not just take it, but stand up for it. But I think the open relationship with the grandparents or the parents is just so important, because once a child shuts down because they've been made fun of by an adult, oh, well, that was just a little thing. You just need to get over it. You need to grow up. I think then you shut the door, and the child is going to say, well, I guess I do deserve it. I guess I am not any better than this. And you just can't expect a child to react like a mature adult should be acting at all.
Mm-hmm. But if a child, what happens if a child is being bullied? They go to the principal, they indicate what's happening, and he or she just get over it. Oh, that's nothing. Smile with the kids, tease them back, and it'll stop. If they are kind of trivializing of what happened, that's a danger you run. It's a danger you run if you talk to a parent, any adult. They'll trivialize it and just make you feel worse.
It is very much a danger, but because bullying has come out in the open, I believe in every state there's anti-bullying laws, and they are effective in the schools. And if the teachers or our principals do not take it seriously, I believe there's ramifications for them. But, of course, that's going to have to be initiated now by an adult. And it could go through the school board, or it could even go through the school board. And if you still have no relief, I think the media is a place, hey, bullying is going on at such and such school. And with the advent of the texting and the cell phones, there's an awful lot of the cyberbullying going on besides just the in-person bullying that's going on. So, but there's laws against it, and I think if a parent or grandparent doesn't stand up for that child, they're asking for that child to be hurt for a very long time.
Now, if we talk about bullying as a power issue, in other words, I'm doing it because I can do it, don't older people stand at risk of being bullied because of their mental or their physical condition? How can they protect themselves?
Well, you have people that are considered the elderly population, and to my knowledge, also there's laws in every state against bullying or abusing an elder person, and quite often that person maybe is not physically or mentally able to defend themselves. And I have seen cases where somebody was living with a son or daughter, and they were being hollered at, or they were being physically abused. And, of course, you see that in nursing homes where people are being abused. And I think somebody needs to stand up and say no more. And if that elder person is not able, either physically or mentally, to do that, and somebody else sees it, a family friend or another family member, I think they need to step in the gap and intervene on behalf of that, and not just ignore it, that it's going to go away, or say something to, well, you know how she is. Well, no, she doesn't have the right to mistreat somebody else, or he doesn't have the right to mistreat somebody else.
Now, I'm going to come up with something that some people might consider rather controversial. The bully often has problems of their own that need to be treated. If somebody is abusing an older person, I am not defending it, but maybe they're working all day, things are rough on their job, they come home and it's time to eat dinner. No, I won't eat dinner. Or having to deal with a person who has a lot of physical problems, whose mental state may not be perfect, they're under a lot of pressure. Yelling isn't the way to handle it. But
I think that's where the person that is the caregiver, shall we say, needs to have a reprieve from that. And there are agencies that can help put those things in effect, where maybe you have a caregiver that comes into the home a few hours a week or something, where you can just unwind and walk away. If you find yourself as the caregiver or in a home where there is a situation where somebody is caring for an elderly person that can be stubborn, can be difficult, can have physical issues where they can't, like, change their underwear or go to the bathroom or have things like that, then I think you need to have some help, some community support. And in pretty much every larger community, anyway, there are support systems that need to be accessed, whether it's an abuse hotline or whether it's just a community on aging or action on agency or whatever it's called. But there's agencies that can help you if you find yourself losing it because you're under so much stress on your job and you're trying to take care of your kids, and now you've got an elderly person that's that you're also responsible for. It can be incredibly overwhelming. It doesn't make it right to abuse them, but that's where you need to back off just a little bit and get some help yourself.
Linda, thank you very much for being on our program. And if somebody would like to contact you to continue this discussion further or for more information, how can they reach you?
The absolute best way to reach me, Harriet, is at my website, which is www.nonobully.com. And they'll find the book there and some other resources there, but it's nonobully.com.
Thank you very much. I would like to invite all our listeners to visit my new website at harriettramer.com. Click on A Place to Grow, which is on the left side of the screen, and a survey that might help you determine if your elder can safely age at home will download. This arrangement has many benefits in that it provides an elder with more privacy, personalized care than would any institutionalized setting. But it can also prove costly in terms of time and money. So these decisions can prove very difficult, and they might have to constantly be reconsidered. Again, visit us at our new website, harriettramer.com, and be sure to show us that you like us. Thank you very much for listening. Heidi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You indicate, when we've talked before, that people have misconceptions about hospice and what hospice can do to benefit them. What are some of these misconceptions?
I think the biggest misconception that I run into is that people think when they hear the word hospice care, it means that the person only has hours to days left to live. And based on the Medicare conditions of participation, as long as a doctor states that an individual's disease process would indicate if it took its normal trajectory that they have months versus years left to live, then they would be considered appropriate to receive a hospice level of care. However, because so many people have equated hospice with just final days, many people wait much longer to call and initiate services, and there's so much we can do in those final months of a person's life. And I think one of the other big misconceptions is that hospice is just a place, and it really is not. It's a philosophy of care, and we can provide hospice services to a patient and their family wherever they call home, be it in a nursing home, an assisted living, an independent living, an individual's home. We've even provided services to homeless persons who are living out on the streets. So it really is about the philosophy of care as opposed to a physical place where people can go.
You say it is a philosophy of care. Could you describe a little bit what you mean by a philosophy of care?
When we talk about hospice care, it is a level of care that we provide, much in the way when a mother first gets pregnant, she goes to an obstetrician and a gynecologist for care. And when that baby is born, they go to a pediatrician and they are receiving care at that level. And as we age, we go to a general internist and then ultimately to a geriatrician. Well, hospice care is a level of care that we walk alongside a patient, whatever age in life they are, and provide care in addition to what they may be receiving from their physician at whatever point in life they are at. And it's really about comfort and dignity and choice as we look at end-of-life issues for a patient and for the family that's with them.
Can you give us some examples that would help us to better understand hospice care? Some examples of what it's done for people?
Oh, sure. In fact, it's people don't realize how many aspects there are to hospice care, and we view it as a holistic approach to providing care to a patient and their family, so that we look at not just the physical things that a patient may be going through, but also emotionally, spiritually. And it's beyond just that individual patient, but also their family circle, the friends around them, and the people that they choose to have with them during this part of their journey. We have a nurse who will see the patient and addresses many of the clinical needs. We have nursing assistants who come in and assist with personal care like hygiene and bathing, showering, those types of things. We provide a social worker to help with any care concerns in terms of benefits and looking at the emotional pieces that may go along with that. We have a spiritual care coordinator who will help address some of those spiritual needs as we approach the end of life. But we also have what we call our expressive therapies. We have massage therapy, art therapy, music therapy, pet therapy. We have volunteers who come in and will allow respite for the caregiver or just to be a companion to the patient and their family. And so it really is more than just a nurse or a doctor coming in to see about a patient. And so, again, it's that holistic approach to care. And it is just amazing to see how patients and families benefit from the many interventions that we are able to do. For example, when we bring in music therapy, a lot of people are not necessarily able to express their emotions and the things that they're feeling, especially at a sensitive time as we approach the end of life. But through music, they're able to express things that they've not been able to give voice to. When we're looking at patients with dementia, many of them are not able to verbalize direct thoughts or responses to questions, but they can still hold on to the tunes and the words to songs, and a music therapist will start to play, and they can actually sing along with the lyrics that they've not been able to form a coherent sentence for many months. And we also have our pet therapy and our dogs that are at our hospice houses. And we have some pet volunteers who will bring their dogs to visit with patients. And just the calmness of the animals kind of reaches a point and touches people in a place that sometimes individuals can't. And they will react and respond to the dogs. And where they may have been anxious before, when the dog comes in the room, they're much calmer, more peaceful, and able to focus. And we find that using these expressive therapies, ways to reach people other than just physical, clinical touches, allows them to find relief for other emotional pain or spiritual pain that may not be adequately addressed just through pharmacological methods.
Now, from what you're describing, certain pictures come to me. Is it possible that somebody in hospice begins to discover some gifts they had that they never knew they had because their life may have not been given them an opportunity to explore these gifts? Have you ever had somebody maybe who would have said, "I have absolutely no musical talent, went to music therapy and showed that they might have some talent or at least some sensitivities in this area. Have you ever had people who said, I have no art talent whatsoever? If you gave me a ruler, I could not draw a straight line. Went into art therapy and found they might have some talents in this area?
Absolutely.
Do things of that nature ever happen when somebody's in hospice?
Oh, definitely. And it is why one of the things we frequently say is we may not be able to add more days to your life, but we do our best to add more life to your days. And if you were to come to one of our hospice houses, we actually have two. We have the David Simpson Hospice House and the Ames Family Hospice House. And we have artwork that has been done by patients who, as they were approaching the end of life, our art therapists are able to help direct them, and they come up with some beautiful pieces that they had no idea that they had this kind of talent or the ability to express their emotions and their thoughts artistically, because so often we think the only way we can give voice to what we're feeling is by saying words. But quite often it's able to be done either in paintings or using textiles or other means of crafting. We have individuals who have a voice and actually will sing with our music therapist, who would never think they could carry a tune even in a bucket. And yet, at this point, you know, I think some of our inhibitions are let down because we realize, what do we have left to lose? What is it going to hurt if I take a chance now and try to exhibit some talent that I've never tapped into before, or find some skills and gifts that have previously, you know, just been a dream? One of the things we like to do is, through our life enrichment and legacy projects, try to help people reach some of those dreams, those things they've always said they wanted to do and maybe not had an opportunity to do or not been able to do on the scale that they would like to do. Because in those precious moments, we don't want people to think that just because you've received a diagnosis that your life ends today. We want you to be able to live as fully as you possibly can until that last moment.
Now, you are spiritual care coordinator for the Hospice of Western Reserve.
Yes.
These are tricky things to discuss, I understand. But have you had people who their entire life said, I'm a disbeliever, I don't go to church, temple, mosque, whatever, I'm a complete disbeliever, who began to get some sensitivities towards a higher order? I'll say higher order to avoid being too much a part of any tradition. And they never thought they would say something or feel something like that. Have you experienced that happening?
I think the old saying, there's no atheists in foxholes. I think as we
you
come
said it, I didn't.
I think as we come toward the end of life, we realize that there is a hope that there is something greater beyond us. We don't always know what that is or what form that's going to take, but I think inherently most of us, I won't say all, but most of us have this belief that there's something else. And I like to tell people that we all have faith in something. Even as simple as trusting that when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to be breathing. That's taking that on faith. And so we are non-denominational. We're not out there trying to convert souls, and we're not out there trying to make people believe in something or someone or anything, but tapping into the fact that each of us has a soul. There's something inside each of us that's beating, that's breathing, that's living, and finding a way to connect with that. And as you said, for some it's the recognition of a higher power or a source of strength that they may be able to find or give voice to. For some it's been a defense mechanism. And sometimes they feel like, you know what, maybe I need to let this guard down. Maybe I need to explore, is there something more to this? But is it something that we say we can find for everybody? Of course not. Everybody is different. Each one is an individual. But we are open to trying to help people who say that they want to explore, that maybe there's more to this than what we originally thought.
Now, have you had people who take the opposite approach and say, hey, wait a minute, I never believed? now my prognosis is not good. Why should I start to believe now? Where's this higher order? Where is it doing anything for me now? Have you had many people who are very resistant in that way? Very angry?
I won't say that I have run into that a lot in terms of just totally now, because I'm at the end of life, I'm not going to believe in anything or believe there's someone I should believe in or something. You do get the anger, but that's a natural part of the grief process. When someone receives a diagnosis that, hey, I thought I had 50 more years to live, and you're telling me I may have 6 months on the outside, that is a natural part of the process. The denial, the anger, the bargaining, all of that goes into it. And so we don't try to dissuade somebody and say, oh, you're not feeling that, or you shouldn't feel that way. We allow people to feel how they are feeling, and that is a whole part of what it means to provide end-of-life care, allowing people to sit where they are and to meet them at that point and say, you know, I cannot tell you how you should be feeling right now. I can't imagine how you're feeling right now, because I'm truly not the one living through what you're living through. But I am here to listen. I am here to give a shoulder. I am here to give an ear. And so helping people to walk through that part of the journey, whichever way they are heading at that point in time.
Now, as spiritual coordinator, do you come and talk to everybody who's in hospice care? Do people have to request that you come and talk to them? How does this function?
Well, it is an integral part of the care team. So we have a transdisciplinary team that consists of a nurse, a social worker, a nursing assistant, and spiritual care that are the primary team to provide care for each patient and their family. But we believe in as much or as little as a patient or a family wants or needs at that point in time. So we don't force ourselves on them. If they say, you know what, I'm okay, I don't feel like I need a spiritual care coordinator right now, I'll call you when I'm ready, then we say, okay, we're here. Or they may say, I really need you, can you come every week? And we'll do that. It's not something that they have to do extra. It's part of the hospice plan of care.
You and others are working to make people more aware of the benefits hospice can provide. Do you have any indication that, in fact, this campaign is having an impact, that people are becoming more aware of these matters?
Oh, most definitely. If you look at statistics in just the last 10 to 12 years, the number of people who have utilized hospice care at the end of life, the number is more than double in the last 10 years. And so clearly people are getting a better understanding of just what hospice care is and what hospice care is not. If I look at numbers, back in 2000, 31% of Medicare recipients who passed away did so with hospice care. Now it's over 66%.
Really?
We've gone from 1 in 3 to more than 2 in 3 people receiving hospice care at end of life. And so I'm sorry, go ahead.
To what do you attribute this increase? Do you think the medical profession itself is becoming more sensitized to these matters? The general public simply knows more about these matters? These things are discussed more openly? What do you think is responsible for this increase?
I would say all of the above, Harriet. I mean, it truly is more physicians are recognizing that this is a natural part of the life cycle. We are working very well collaboratively with physicians in hospital settings and nursing homes and assisted living. And what we are finding, statistics bear out, that patients actually live somewhat longer under a hospice level of care than they do in an acute inpatient in a hospital setting, because it is more peaceful. It is more focused on that end-of-life care, on making sure that people have had an opportunity to make amends, to see loved ones that they haven't seen, to bring things into perspective. And we don't try to replace the physician. We work hand in hand alongside the physician. And so I think part of that thought process before was that, you know, I'm going to hold on to this patient to the very last moment. But now we realize that, you know what, this is just part of the natural progression. And so you have the medical community that's coming alongside hospice providers and saying, okay, we can do this together. We have the public that is now hearing that word hospice used more and more frequently, and instead of shuddering, they're able to, you know, more often than not say, you know what, my dad had hospice care and I'm so glad they were there, or my next door neighbor had it and they had a wonderful experience. And more often than not, when people find out that I work for a hospice provider, they go, you know, the only thing I wish was that we had known about it sooner. And so I think as that perception gets out there more and more, people are more willing to utilize the services because they find out it really is more than just about those final days.
Mm-hmm. Now, has hospice care started to be discussed in medical school, making it more a part of the medical culture before doctors even become practicing, begin
yes.
practicing?
Yes. And we even have residents and interns who will do rotations through our hospice houses and will meet with our medical directors. So, yes, it is definitely becoming more entrenched in the educational process even before the doctors begin practicing.
Now, people listening to this might say, this is wonderful, but how could I afford this? Are the expenses of hospice care, you mentioned it, but we need to really understand this better. Are these expenses covered by Medicare or Medicaid?
Yes, they are. Hospice care is part of the Medicare benefit for those who are not yet eligible for Medicare and they are receiving Medicaid. There is a Medicaid benefit. Private insurances, many of them do have a hospice benefit associated with them as well. But we also believe that no one should die in pain and no one should die alone. And so we work with families and do what we can to help them if they don't have insurance, if they don't have Medicare, if they don't have Medicaid. We do a lot of work in the community. We do a lot, receive a lot of funding through private donations. And so we provide services to help meet those patients where they are. So even if they don't have, like I said, the Medicare, the Medicaid, or private insurance, we'll work with them.
Now, do you think the fact hospice is now discussed more openly has its genesis in our aging culture as people live longer, hospice may become more of a reality for them? Example, at one point, more people may simply have had a heart attack and that was their end. Now, people are surviving heart attacks and maybe at some point they have heart failure that medical intervention just can't help. Is the fact we are living longer a big part of hospice becoming more a part of our cultural landscape?
I would say that definitely is contributing to it. And because we're having to find more, I hate to use the word, but creative ways to provide care for our loved ones, it is almost astronomical to think about the financial burden that would be placed on a family to keep a loved one in a nursing home or an assisted living for a prolonged period of time. Hospice care allows us to bring the hospice care to you in your home if you are still able to be there with your children or spouse or siblings. And so it's an option and provides alternatives to those families who might say, you know, I can't bear the thought of putting my loved one in a nursing home, but I know I need more assistance, and as they're aging and they're, you know, going along in this disease process, I know I'm going to need somebody to come alongside me. And so we're able to do that and bring that into the home and be there so that probably 85% of people surveyed say they would much rather die at home than in a nursing home or in a hospital. But with our culture with, you know, two-parent household working and needing all that extra income and needing to be outside of the home, it seems almost impossible to keep our loved ones at home. But this is an opportunity to say, you know what, I can make the stretch. If I've got some help, I can keep my mom at home or my spouse can stay at home. And so as we're seeing more of that, it's becoming more acceptable because, you know what, this gives me the opportunity to do what I really want to do for my loved one. And how many children have promised parents, Mom, don't worry, I'm never going to put you in a nursing home, or, you know, we're going to keep you at home as long as we possibly can. And this is a way that we can honor those promises we've made to our loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you see if you look 10 years into the future? Do you see hospice becoming more and more a part of American life? Or do you think people will begin to say, hey, that's not the way I want to go? Do you think there will be some type of a backlash to this, or do you think it will be continuously more accepted?
Based on what we have seen over time, I would only see the trajectory continuing to grow. I think as people realize that, one, none of us are going to be here forever, and death should not be that taboo word that we just don't talk about in polite circles. It's a part of the life process. Everyone who is born at some point in time is going to die. And so if there's an opportunity for us to have dignity, for us to have a quality of life for whatever those days are that we have, I believe more and more people are going to want to embrace that, especially as they become greater educated to how much better that quality of life can be when we utilize these services that are available. So I truly believe that it is going to become even more commonplace than what it's becoming right now.
Now, in closing, is there something else that you think people should know about hospice care that hasn't been discussed?
I can't really think of anything else, but I will say that my goal personally as an individual who truly believes in the mission of hospice care, my goal is that patients and families are accepting of hospice care at the end of life as we are of pediatric care at the beginning of life. I don't think there's 99 out of 100 people that you would survey that would have any qualms about saying a child needs pediatric care when they're born. And my goal is that those same 99 people will have no qualms about having hospice care when it comes to the end of life.
Heidi, thank you very much for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. You've certainly taught me something, and I believe you've taught our listeners something. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
This is Harriet Tramer. I hope you'll join us Reaching for the Goal 2 weeks from now when we're aired every Tuesday afternoon at this time. And I also hope you'll visit my website at www.htramer.com. And it would be really great if you could show you appreciate the site by liking us. Thank you for listening.